Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the FT Business Books podcast. I'm Isabel Barrick, Executive Editor at FT Work and Careers, and joining me today is my colleague Helen Barrett, Work and Careers Editor.
Hello.
We're recording this series of the podcast around the theme of how to live and work better in a tech-driven age, and we're talking about new books that offer advice and practical steps towards that dream. It's ahead of the launch of the 2018 FT and McKinsey Business Book of the Year Prize later this spring. Today we'll be talking to Leah Weiss, who's teaches at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Her brand new book, How We Work, has the frankly irresistible subtitle, Live Your Purpose, Reclaim Your Sanity and Embrace the Daily Grind. Leah joins us on the line from the US. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And I'm excited to talk to you because you've been practicing Tibetan meditation and compassion practice for decades. I mean, you actually started as a teenager. But how did this personal practice and teaching turn into a book?
It was a bit of a meandering path. But along the way, I did a number of long 100-day, 6-month meditation retreats alongside graduate school, first in social work, and then I got a doctorate in education and Buddhist studies, which then took me to the Compassion Center at Stanford as their director of education, working closely with Thubten Jinpa, the Dalai Lama's interpreter, to create and direct the teacher training program for our compassion course. And we've trained folks from around the world in that curriculum. And I also, when I got back to Stanford, had the opportunity to start teaching at the business school. So I've been doing that for about 6 years, and it's been a wonderful process, and along the way doing more with organizations who are looking to improve their culture, their teams, and their leadership development. And the book is really out of all of that.
Leah, you teach at Stanford, which is the university that gave the business world design thinking, David Kelly's famous theory, and interpersonal dynamics, which is also known as the touchy-feely class. And in the book, you talk about how these concepts that have come out of Stanford are similar concepts to something called Dapper Sum. Tell us about why Stanford in particular is so good at adapting these theories and selling them to the rest of the world.
I just spent the day at the D School last week. There's a class where they're doing projects in the mindfulness space, and it was such a wonderful opportunity to bring together all of these different aspects of the design thinking process, where I had shared with them information about mindfulness, and then out of that, they would develop a plan, and this maps on to the first stage of Dhampa Sum, which is setting an intention, and then they would do experiments and then reflect on them and cycle through again, and this maps on, and this is part of what we were talking about, it maps on so closely with the design thinking process. And it was great to see them document along the way where they would have an initial concept and go out and do interviews and do a prototype and test that and then further develop and iterate again.
Because so it means good at the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. Is that right?
Yes, and this is the way that I think we are failing in the translation of mindfulness and compassion practices.
You talk a lot in the book about compassion in the workplace and in life and how that differs from empathy, which seems a very useful distinction. It wasn't one I'd really thought about before. Could you explain how that works in practice?
So I think one of the clearest places to really get a handle on that is if you look at professional care providers. So for the purpose of this discussion, say we're talking about physicians and nurses. So day in and day out, it's their job to respond to suffering. They are working with people who are in distress. So an empathetic response would indicate that you're feeling with the other person's distress. And in terms of the neuroscience of empathy, what happens is that our brains light up in the same regions, mirroring the experience of the person who is in distress. And we are not wired to sustain that kind of response over time, so you get what we have now, which is an epidemic of burnout in the healthcare industry. So the thing to change here is that the answer isn't to be a robot and depersonalize, but there's another way of relating with the suffering, of engaging with compassion, where you are connected to the other person, recognizing their humanity, but you're able to respond because you're not in empathetic distress yourself.
That's interesting, because the idea in the book that you treat people just as you would wish to be treated, what if all human beings are just like us, is actually quite a radical statement for business, because most business theories are about beating other people or treating people as commodities or tools to meet corporate goals. And as part of this sort of thing about compassion, you talk about a fully humanized workplace. What would that look like, and have you ever seen one?
So I think that this is the way of the future. This is going to be, we know from research that organizations who have the capacity to mobilize compassionately when their employees who are humans and who inevitably experience sickness, loss of loved ones, all the things that we all have happen in life, the organizations who are able to respond to this, demonstrating not only to the person who's suffering, but to all of the people around them who are noticing. When organizations don't take care of their employees, they will not have employees who will be loyal to them. And what we see in the organizations that lack compassion, that mortgage their employees' well-being for short-term gains, their employees leave. Their retention rates cost them, actually, a huge amount of money. So there's this coming together of what makes sense on the human level to be compassionate with the bottom line, which is going to reward you. There's nothing more costly than losing employees again and again, which is what happens in these toxic workplaces. So I think smart organizations are recognizing this. About 3 weeks ago, I had Jeff Weiner, the CEO of LinkedIn, come into my class at Stanford. And, LinkedIn's a great example of an organization that's looking at this and working to bring compassion in to the hiring processes, to the annual performance reviews, into the way that they're doing business. So noticing what employees are doing in terms of fostering the development of the people around them. We have come to the recognition in the fields of HR and learning and development that there's a problem that the people who are promoted because they're good at whatever they're good at, they eventually reach a point where their job becomes managing other people, which is a different skill set than what got them there in the first place. So these emotional intelligence or soft skills or compassion-related skills become the currency, and they actually are what hiring managers and executives point to as the biggest challenge to find, which makes people who have this combination of technical and human skills, if you have both of these, then you're going to be in huge demand.
I've visited a lot of business schools and I've spoken to a lot of business school students, and they're an incredibly ambitious and focused group. How do you convince your classes at Stanford that this is important? How receptive are the students to this theory?
My class always has waiting lists. I teach multiple sections. Mm-hmm. I think that there is a recognition that the human side of work really matters. Gone are the days where people picked a company because they have, a cool ping pong table room and whatever kind of food perks. I think what the millennials are looking for is, based on what we know of them prioritizing purpose, they want to live lives that are more aligned with what they care about, and they want their workplaces to meet them there. So they come into my class trying to, A, develop themselves personally as leaders, and they understand the value of these people skills and know that this will translate into more effective work and also better lives. And they're also looking to learn how they can steer their organizations in this direction, and they're selecting their jobs based on the organizations that are demonstrating these values.
I think that's great for people who are taking those choices themselves, but what about people who are stuck in toxic working environments? What would you say to them to help them to stay sane? How can the mindfulness process work? And can soft skills work wonders?
There's examples that I talk about in the book that I think are inspiring for all of us. You know, people who work like Dr. Amy Riznetsky out of the Yale School of Management, who is an expert in the field of purpose, and she's researched in a number of different jobs, including janitors in hospitals. And she'll find people who express tremendous amount of commitment and purpose and calling. What she talks about is that there are three ways of perceiving our jobs. Are as a job in terms of like it's an exchange of time for money, as a career, which is more focused on the long term, what I learned today will translate into something I want tomorrow. And then there's this calling idea of my work itself is meaningful. And actually what you find is that there's people in all kinds of positions, including janitors in hospitals, who view their work as a calling, who, if you ask them, which Dr. Riznetsky did, about their work, they'll say, I'm an instrumental part of the care team. If I don't do my job well, people will die. I think that we can bring purpose into whatever role that we're in. There's a lot more we can do with our own mindset than we tend to acknowledge, which then also brings a responsibility that, you know, we can do any job, and there are people, if we watch in the world around us, there are people doing any number of jobs with great dignity and who really care about the people that they're interacting with. That's who we should be taking our cue from.
Do you think that there's a conflict between what organizations need from their employees and what its workers want?
I think that there will always be tensions between the how and the process of work, or the paying attention and how to value the various, as Arianna Huffington puts it, the various metrics. So I think increasingly we're living in a time where more and more organizations understand that just the dollars isn't sufficient to understand success. And I think that as we're moving in this direction, when we're thinking about the human element, about environmental externalities, that the discussions become richer and in some ways more complex, but I think they always were complex. We just didn't pay attention to much of what was happening, because if you just focus on the short-term financials, you're going to make a different decision than if you're even focusing on what's the financial best practice if I'm looking 5 years out as opposed to just now. And what if I'm thinking about retaining my workforce instead of making the biggest margin this year? So I think there will always be discussions and strategic questions around this.
What would you say, Leah, is the single thing we could all do to make our experience of work better, whatever it is we do? Is there a silver bullet here?
One of the things we know is that the workforce is at an all-time crisis in engagement, that one out of three people actually know how their role in their organization fits in with what the organization's supposed to do. We don't know, so that means two-thirds of people do not know what they're doing and why. So it's very difficult to be engaged. It's very difficult to care. It's very difficult to actually prioritize where we should be spending our time. So I'd say the single most important thing to start with is understand. Don't be afraid to ask questions and to continue to update your thinking in relation to the people around you as strategy changes over time, to understand what is your purpose, what is the value you're bringing, how can you understand that more clearly so you can execute on it more effectively.
I am very British, Leah, and I can imagine that lots of other British managers might read your book and think, this is all very well if you're in California, and this is all very Californian, but this doesn't apply to me. How would you respond to that?
I would say ignore it as an employer at your own peril, because you are going to, no matter how pragmatic you are, retaining your workforce, getting the highest engagement out of them is just good business. So if you're ignoring a method that is shown by research, we know works to increase productivity, to increase efficiency, there's just no logic there. There's nothing to do with California or England or wherever you are in the world. There's just good business sense, which includes that no matter what our work is, there's other people involved in it. And the better we can work with those other people, the more efficient, creative, and so on that we're going to be.
I can hear the traffic in the background there in New York. So to wrap up, as an antidote to this rather tech-obsessed and rather fraught world, we're trying to finish every podcast in our series with our what we like to call life-affirming recommendations for what we've read recently. Leah, would you like to go first?
So the book I wanted to bring to mind is a classic by Dr. Seuss, The Lorax, which I was just rereading with my three-year-old over and over again. And it is, in my mind, more on point than ever. And I actually just wrote an essay about it, that comparing what we need to do in terms of understanding the human, the environmental implications of our choices as individuals, as organizations. So The Lorax, that's mine.
Helen? I have lined up a book by Deborah Levy called Things I Don't Want to Know, which has not long been published, and it is a riposte to George Orwell's 1946 essay, Why I Write. It's a feminist riposte, which looks at the ego that Orwell brings to his, or the egoism he brings to Why I Write, and deconstructs it from a feminist point of view. I'm really looking forward to reading that one.
That sounds excellent. And I have just read for review, actually, in the FT, a book called Hotel Silence. It's a novel by an Icelandic author called, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Arthur Eifer Olafsdottir. And it's about a middle-aged man who finds redemption in a hotel in a war-torn country. And it sounds gloomy, but actually, it's rather wonderful. Well, that's it for us this week. My thanks to Leah Weiss in the United States, to Helen Barrett here in the studio, and to our producer, Patricia Nielsen. Join us next time when we'll be talking about another new book that aims to help us thrive in a tech-dominated age.